Yes, as I said, I would like to thank the organizers for this opportunity to give the today's Strong Gravity seminar. I will talk about space-times beyond Kerr theory using two different approaches. But before that, I would like to motivate the need for quantum gravity in the singularity resolutions of the space-times. And that will be the first part of the talk. So the first part of the talk will be about space-times beyond Kerr. And the second part of the talk, I would like to move towards their observational signatures and what we can say about their properties in Brakhov images. So the theoretical description of Kerr-Brakhov's in general relativity is plagued by singularities. And there are three types of singularities you can think of. The first type, one being that the scalar curvature invariants are blowing up at the centers. The second one being that you might have geodesic incompleteness. You might reach the singularity in a finite amount of proper time. And the third one is that you might have formation of naive singularity if you are overspinning, for example, a Kerr black hole. And if you introduce a new quantum physics effect, you might expect to at least partially cure these singularities. And this is because by introducing this new physics effect, you will weaken gravity. And by weakening gravity, you can make the singularities softer, or you can even cure them entirely.
What do you mean by making it softer?
That they are integrable, for example. So that will be part of the first part of my talk. And then I would like to emphasize that although so far no departure from GR has been observed in Brakhov images, for example, current and future observational tools will allow us to probe better and to sort of quantify deviations from GR and alternatives to GR. So if you want to derive spacetimes beyond Kerr, you can use three different approaches. The first one is the so-called fundamental approach, in which you have a quantum gravity theory, and this relies on a specific form of new physics. This is, for example, the case of asymptotic safety, and you can use asymptotic safety-inspired methods to upgrade your constant coupling into running couplings in your metric. The problem of this is that it's not really comprehensive because it's you need to derive your spacetime for each particular theory you have. So you can choose another approach, which is the so-called parameterized approach, in which you parameterize deviations from your Kerr spacetime. And this is, for example, the case of non-circular parameterization of Brakhov's, which I will talk later on. The problem of this one is that it has little connection to new physics. So you just enter some deviations, but you don't motivate from physics phenomenon. So you can take a route in between, called the principal parameterized approach, in which now you motivate your deviations from new physics guiding principles. And those can lead to non-singular Brakhov spacetime. And this is will be, for example, the case of introducing new physics effect as a function f in your metric, which is based on some principles. So this is the approach I will start talking about. So this approach relies on four new physics guiding principles, which are the following. You would like your spacetime to have the correct Newtonian limits, because we have tests in the weak field regime of GR, and those should match with the spacetime you are deriving. You would like also your spacetime to be regular everywhere, so you need to ensure regularity when you're coming up with your metric. You also want to ensure locality, which is coming from the fact that you expect deviations from GR to be larger when the local curvature scale becomes larger. So you need to tie these two effects. So deviation grow when the curvature scale grows. And finally, you would like your new physics effect to enter at a single new physics scale, which is called simplicity. So those beyond GR principles are going to be used as a motivation to have properties of space-time matrix beyond GR. And how those are generally entering your matrix is under the form of upgrading your constant mass to a mass function and upgrading your couplings or your Newton constant to a function, such that the function depends on your local curvature scale k and your new physics scale, which is either omega or RNP in this case. And this is to ensure locality and simplicity. But then, once you have upgraded this constant to functions in your spacetime metric, you need to make sure that the upgraded versions satisfies regularity and also has the correct Newtonian limit.
Yeah, by regularity, you mean absence of singularities, or for instance, an integral singularity would be acceptable?
Here it would be absence of singularity mostly.
So you're looking just to get match theories which are only metric and fundamental variables, that's like this assumption. I mean, you can have theories with metrics and connections, they don't actually connect it with each other, or you can have other lines and singularity theories and so on and so forth. So
I'm staying at the level of the metric itself. Yeah.
The metric is only basic variable. You do not
yes.
have
any
features. Yes. So I guess the question is the flat connection. There's no non-metricity, no torsion.
No, but I'm not assuming this a priori. So now the question is, how can this new physics effect, for example, impact the gravitational collapse of a spherical shell into a spherically symmetric black hole?
So maybe I can ask a question here. This would be a question that if Eric were here, he would always ask this kind of question. So so you're talking about this modification to the curve paramount. Are you imagining like the modification, like, I don't know, Planck scale or something like that? Or
I mean, I don't assume that this is the Planck scale. I'm just postulating that there is a scale at which new physics becomes important.
I see. But if it's quantum gravity motivated, should it be related to Planck scale by definition, or can you have larger impact than that?
I guess that depends on your model. I mean, for example, in the case of asymptotic safety inspired, in general, you assume that your new physics scale is the Planck scale. But here I'm not assuming that it's tied to the Planck scale.
Okay, yeah. I guess for us, we always have the question, right? Like, we can measure gravitational waves from black holes, but if anything is like Planck scale or modification, then we can never measure this kind of thing.
Yes, but we will see in the second part that even though there is new physics at a particularly high scale, you can still have some specific effects that you can, at the level of the horizon of your space.
Okay.
So, as I said, I will use the principal parameterized approach on the general Bayesian spacetime, which describes the gravitational collapse of a spherically symmetric and asymptotically flat radiating star. And this is made of no dust and no fluid. And this is dynamical spacetime, I mean, by definition, and it could lead to a spherically symmetric black hole. So the line element of such a spacetime is written in Eddington-Finkelstein coordinates. And the mass is here a mass function of the advance time v and the coordinate r. And this describes deviation from Schwarzschild. So if this mass function is a constant, m, you get back the line element of Schwarzschild. If this m is only dependent on v, this is the so-called classical Bayesian spacetime. And if you have a R dependence, this is the case. This is the general Bayesian spacetime. So since we want to look at the formation of a black hole, you need your mass to be positive and also increasing. So how do we? What is the recipe of this approach applied to the gravitational collapse? First, what you need to do is to consider your m as being the classical m of v, so no R dependence. And for that, you derive all the polynomially independent scalar curvature invariants. And in that case, there are only six that are independent and non-zero. And you realize that they are all singular at R going to zero, meaning that if you want to implement regularity, you need to introduce this R dependence. But you need to introduce it in a specific way to satisfy the locality and the simplicity principle, meaning that the R dependence should only be in the factor k times Rnp squared, which is local curvature scale times new physics. So you want your mass function to be the classical case times a modified, a function of encoding new physics. And in that case, you can write, this is a choice, you can write the local curvature scale k as being the root mean square of your curvature invariant to certain power to ensure the same order in curvature. And it turns out that in that case, only I1, so the first curvature invariant matters, which is the vi tensor squared. So you can rewrite k as being square root of I1. And then once you have that, you plug back k in f, and you plug back this mass function in your line element. And this is the upgraded mass function that you get. And there is a standard choice for M of V, which is called the Validia-Kuroda-Papapetru model, where it's just linear in V, so you just have an increase in mass linearly with the advance time. And your mu factor is positive, and it is the accretion rate of your future black hole. Okay, so I just put the mass function as a reminder. And I want to show you how this new physics function evolves in terms of time. So the case where you have only the classical case is the case for which f is 1, so at large v. And modifications occur for smaller v, as you can see. And what you are now interested in is that you have your space-time metric, and you would like to determine what are the properties of this metric, what we can say about this metric. And one interesting feature is that whether there is an apparent horizon forming or not. And for that, you would like to solve, to find the roots of this equation. So taking the VV component of your metric being zero. And this you can do for several n's. So as you remember, in the mass function, you had a power n in the denominator, and you could in principle take several values for this n. So what I plotted here is the real part of the location of the apparent horizon and the imaginary part in the bottom. I will use that. You have also the value of mu and the specific value of v. So what does that tell you? It tells you that there is an apparent horizon forming, which are the curves on top, and also an inner horizon forming, which are the curves in the bottom. And this you cannot see in that plot, but you expect that your apparent horizon is shorter than your classical case, so where there is only M of V. And that is because you have weakened gravity. And as you weaken gravity, this will make the mass of your black hole smaller, and therefore you expect a smaller horizon as well. And what you can observe as well is that after or at a certain scale, which is the critical new physics scale, your spacetime becomes horizonless because your apparent horizon and inner horizon merge and they become imaginary. So you get a horizonless spacetime. You can see that this critical value of the new physics scale is dependent on V. So this was for V equal 10, and this is for V equals 100. And you can see that the critical scale increases. And this is actually interesting, because that tells you that when your new physics scale is larger than this critical scale, there is no apparent horizon. And therefore, whatever new physics that there is can be, in principle, seen by an observer, because nothing prevents it from, you know, it's not hidden behind an horizon. And just as a side comment, you can see that the critical scale is increasing with n. This is because as n grows, your modification reaches 1 quicker. Therefore, there is less space for new physics to develop. You can apply the same idea for another case where instead of upgrading your mass, you upgrade the Newton coupling into a function, and you take this function to be the one from asymptotic safety. So this is an asymptotic safety inspired upgrade of your Newton coupling into a running coupling, and it depends also on the local curvature scale and your new physics scale. So now your new physics scale is omega. And as before, we have also apparent horizon, inner horizon, and the same properties apply.
What is the dimension of omega?
Sorry?
What is the dimension of omega?
It's a scale. It's a, it's your new physics scale.
Is it length?
Yeah, it's a length. Yes. I mean, in that case, omega is the, I mean, it's dimensionless in that case.
It's dimensionless?
Yeah, this one is dimensionless.
So, I guess, so the theory has a new constant, is that right?
Sorry?
Does the theory have a new constant?
Yeah, the theory has a new physics scale, which in that case is omega.
But where the scale? Does the theory have a constant, a new constant that is built into it?
I mean, I'm not working at the level of a theory. I'm just having the metric and upgrading the Newton constant into a function that depends on this scale.
Okay, I can quickly clarify. Omega is the dimensionless fixed point value of the new coupling. So you can translate that into how far beyond or below the Planck scale the dimension is reached. So the new physics scale is omega times the Planck mass.
Yeah. So far we have looked at the apparent horizon, but we can also look at the photon sphere. Because in the classical case where the mass function only depends on V, there is an analytical solution for the regulation of the photon sphere, which is given by R gamma. And there is also a conformal Killing vector. But it turns out that when we modify our mass function with new physics input, we lose this conformal Killing vector. And that implies that we cannot find an analytical solution for the location of the photon sphere. So instead, what we can do is to look at deviations between our modified spacetime and the classical case at the location of the photon sphere in the classical case. And this is the result. So here we plot the deviations in function of the new physics scale for the two different values of the accretion rate, which is mu, and also at different time. So what you can see first is that in both cases, the curves are limited by the critical value of your new physics scale. Because beyond that, the spacetime is horizonless. And the second thing you can see is that the deviations, so the value of the deviations at maximum, are larger for this small mu than for this mu. Meaning that whenever you have a smaller accretion rate, your deviation can set in and are more important than when your accretion rate is fast. Okay, so this was the principal parameterized approach applied to the gravitational collapse. Now I would like to summarize again that there are these three approaches, and I would like to follow another one.
You always highlighted beyond curve, but it's really beyond Schwarzschild, right? So far it's all Schwarzschild.
Yeah, this was the spherically symmetric, yes, exactly.
Yeah. Well, how do I understand dynamically the collapse of the shell if I don't form like a horizon? What happens?
I mean, you're forming an apparent horizon, which is...
I thought you said it's something that was no apparent horizon.
No, I mean, so you're forming an apparent horizon, but beyond a certain... If the new physics scale is too large, then your spacetime is horizonless. But there is a range for which you will have an apparent horizon.
But in the case I don't have the apparent
horizon... Then it's horizonless.
What would I expect for just a collapsing shell?
Yeah, I mean, it will settle in horizonless spacetime, which has a might have a refractive surface or something like this. Thanks. So yeah, so far I have been talking about this approach, and I would like now to move on to this one, where you are somehow agnostic about the physics when you parameterize your deviation. And here I would like to look at this approach in the prism of which symmetries do existing parameterization have, and also what kind of symmetries do they have beyond Jira. And in this case, I will focus on axisymmetric and stationary spacetimes, such as Kerr. And I would like to tell you that the existing parameterizations for this type of spacetimes make either one or both assumptions. They either assume that there is circularity, and sometimes on top of circularity, they assume that there is a hidden constant of motion, a sort of generalized character constant of motion.
Sorry, what is circularity?
Yeah, I'm going to tell you about it afterwards. So yeah, the motivation that we had is that those might not hold in and beyond GR, because those are additional symmetries that your spacetime might not have, especially if you want to satisfy the locality principle. And there is another argument that most of the parameterizations so far have been written in Boyer-Lindquist coordinates. Kerr is usually written in Boyer-Lindquist coordinates. But I would like to argue that those are not suitable for non-circular spacetimes. So as you abandon circularity, you might want to rather work in horizon-penetrating coordinates. So, circularity. those are mathematical conditions, and they hold whenever those mathematical conditions are satisfied everywhere. And they involve the commuting king vectors, Xi1 and Xi2, and also your Ricci tensor. So this restricts somehow your Ricci tensors in the direction of your king vectors. And what you can, what do they imply is an isometry of your spacetime, which is rather, made more understandable in Boyer-Lindquist coordinates, which basically circularity in those coordinates means that there is invariance under the time reversal and the azimuthal angle reversal. And why don't we want to consider circularity? It's, although in vacuum GR, circularity holds because your Ricci tensor is vanishing everywhere, but there is some case within GR, and I mean non-vacuum GR, and also beyond GR, where circularity has been proven not to hold. So now I would like also to define what is this new hidden constant of motion. So you know that Keegan vectors are implying isometries of your spacetime. And now if you generalize the notion of Keegan vectors, you have rank 2 Keegan tensors. In principle, you can have also a higher rank, but here we are focusing on rank 2. And those imply hidden constant of motions, which are conserved along your geodesics. Of course, the metric itself is a rank 2 Keegan tensors, but that doesn't imply any constant of motion. It just makes sure that your connection is metric compatible. And those constant of motion are a new symmetries because they can lead to the separability of your geodesics equation. So I would like to make a summary of all the different parameterizations and what do they imply in terms of metric components and free functions. So if you consider Brachos in general, you would have 10 metric components. But as you are considering axisymmetry and stationarity, those reduce to 6, and you also have at least 6 free functions. Now, if you, on top of that, assume circularity, and this is the most general circular metric that has been derived, then you would obtain only 5 metric components. And in certain particular coordinates, you can also have only 4 free functions. So you have indeed reduced the number of free parameters in your system. And then on top of circularity, if you add a hidden constant of motion, you would still get 5 metric components. But as you can see in the most general metric that has a hidden constant of motion, your free functions are now depending only on one coordinate and not 2. So you have actually reduced again the freedom. And this is why those form a subclass of circular metric, because they make an additional assumption. So far we have seen that, for example, this metric was written in Bojan-Gyunquist coordinates. But if you want to go beyond circularity, then it's better to work in horizon-penetrating coordinates to avoid spurious curvature singularities at the horizon. And in that goal, you would like to, you can write such a non-circular parameterization in horizon-penetrating coordinate. So this one doesn't assume circularity and hidden constant of motion. And whatever is in blue are your deviations functions. And of course, you would like to satisfy some basic requirements. Namely, you would like your spacetime to be asymptotically flat. So this constrains the deviations at large r. You also would like to have the correct Newtonian limit, so they have to enter at higher order than 1 over r. And you also would like to get back the Flat-Minkowski limit. And yes, contrary-wise to Kerr, when you get the spherically symmetric case when you take the spin to be zero, here, when you take the spin to be zero, you still don't have spherical symmetry. And that is because this chi here encodes an angular dependence, and this breaks spherical symmetry. And that singles out the fact that this spacetime has additional here than usual. So one big challenge, sorry.
I couldn't get, what's the difference between circularity and axis symmetry?
Yeah, it is different. So axis symmetry and stationarity are your basic assumptions, right? Like Kerr fulfills this assumption, and then Kerr also fulfills circularity. But
Kerr is circular.
Yeah, Kerr is circular, and yes. Also had this additional constant of motion.
Yes. Okay.
Yeah, it's an extra assumption.
So circularity refers to 2 Kelvin magnets, whereas axis symmetry is just 1 Kelvin magnet, which is the rotation. For to form of circularity, you need both the stationary and the rotation. It's 2 Kelvin magnets. Yes.
Thank you. So yeah, one big challenge is how do you relate such spacetime that I've read before, the non-circular one, in a certain in HP coordinates, to the circular parameterization which were in Bojan-Gyunquist coordinates, and this is actually very challenging. And what you can do is at least to use a counting argument to justify that, starting from your 14 free functions in your non-circular spacetime, you can get back the 5. Free functions that you had in your circular parameterization. So you start from the 14 free functions, and then you have 9 constraints. So your free functions are subject to this 9 constraint, and therefore, at least a priori, you can have 5 free functions that remain. So with this counting argument, you can relate both prioritizations. And what is still an open question is how to describe a non-circular black hole in Bojan-Gyunquist. So we had horizon-penetrating coordinates before, but what if you want to write non-circular spacetimes in Bojan-Gyunquist coordinates? And what is the minimal metric, the minimal number of free functions you need? So what we have been doing is we came up with a parameterization that has 10 free functions, and that indeed includes all the non-circular and circular cases, but it might not be the minimal one. Okay, I would like to give one example of a spacetime that is included in the non-circular parameterization, which is a locality-based regular black hole. So it is a black hole that satisfies the locality principle, and this is why we upgrade the mass function with an R and a chi dependence. And you can obtain images of this black hole. And this
in what sense is a black hole?
Sorry?
In what sense is it a black hole? Why do you call it a black hole?
I mean, because.
Because?
It has a license.
I mean, can you look at Sklaglers and you can actually see that part of Sklaglers is not all space time? Yes.
Yeah. I depends on the choice of function, but you can choose mass function, so this is just a tiny deviation from curve, and it still has the event horizon.
Yeah, so that is a, the event horizon is a past of. So, but there's an event horizon, but you go inside and there's no singularity.
Yes, so if you choose the mass function properly, then there is no curvature singularity. So it becomes a regular black hole, but it's still a black hole.
And what happens in the Schwarzschild case to this black hole?
I mean, what do you mean? What is the Schwarzschild? I mean, this is supposed to be the generalized curve black hole. Yeah. So this curve is a spin. But you, I could just put, I get a moment to make it to zero, then what do I get? I get a black hole. Well, you don't get a Schwarzschild one, because, I mean, as I said, when you take a going to zero, you don't have a spherically symmetric black hole. In general.
So the question is, you get some space time, which actually has the event horizon. So I go inside the event horizon. And then what happens to
that? I don't know exactly on that case what happens when you take a going to zero.
My problem is the following: that it's not easy to have an event horizon and have a singularity for singularity-free space-time. The reason is because if sky is complete, and if I look at spots, and if you really have that, then what happens? Right?
Yeah.
So maybe universe, there is something.
Yeah, it might be that these black holes typically have an inner G horizon, and so because it's a G horizon, you don't really have a fully consistent regular black hole. So the curvature singularity is lifted, but it's not probably the sort of ultimate answer for what you would want a non-singular black hole.
And that is one of the reasons I was asking for the Schwarzschild case, because there will not be an inner horizon. So it would be good to know what happens to this one.
So for the mass functions that have been looked at, you still have an inner horizon also in the Schwarzschild case.
Even though it is
spinning. Yeah, so you lift the curvature singularity at the cost of introducing a Cauchy horizon.
Thank you. Sorry to interrupt you.
No, it's okay. So yeah, here what we have been doing is to image this regular black hole when it is non-circular, so when the mass function is of this type, and when it is circular, so when the mass function only depends on R. And you can see that there are specific image features in the case of non-circular, right? You have this sort of dent and cusps that you don't see here in the circular case. So that's why this motivates to have a look at how those space-time beyond curve lead to in terms of observational signatures.
Sorry, this is...
Which one? What's first?
in what sense is this an image? What are we looking at?
You ray trace your photons back to obtain such images.
Okay, and when what sort of like where's the emissivity coming from? What's like generating the light? Is it like a disk or is it like a uniform?
Yeah. You use a disk model, yes.
I
mean, you use a sort of intensity model, intensity profile. Yes.
What sort of intensity profiles for this one?
To be honest, I have not been doing this image, so it was Aaron. So I'm not aware of exactly which profile he used. So.
This looks very different from, let's say, the image from EHT or something, right? Like, well, we know you have a donut or whatever. So.
Yeah, this is only one side.
Zoomed in on the bit of the image where it will be most distinct from curve. So, I mean,
yes.
You have the standard donut and then you zoom in on one side, but the deviations from curve are large.
Yeah. So in principle, you have this, I mean, ring-like feature, but this is like a zoom.
I think it's not a disk, I mean, based on what you were saying.
I think it was using a disk.
Yeah. So it's a model for a efficient disk that sort of looks reasonably like a thin disk. I mean, it's not a full geometric dissemination, but it's just a simple disk model with some emissivity. And if you the same disk model with the curve black hole, if you will get something that looks reasonably similar to the EHT image.
But you're looking at the basic photon sphere or photon ring of that space time, right? You don't need a disk actually. That's a it's universal feature of that space time, and you can.
Yeah, I mean, you need your photons to come from somewhere,
yeah,
right?
I mean, you can do ray tracing and consider some photons, and then just find that border, which is they call it shadow, but that central space time critical care would be more accurate thing to use.
Yes, you could, but I mean, more realistically, you would have a disk, so you could, choose
yeah,
to
my point is that
consider different disk
model. Your disk. That
no, this should be a link to your spacetime.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you expect that at least, yeah, that those kind of deviations are linked to your spacetime features, not to the disk model.
But still, I'm not getting why. Yeah. For that, the circular one is care, right?
No, it's not.
Right
because you,
not
the circular one is this, so it's still a mass function. It just doesn't depend on your angle, in a sense. Yeah. So this was a sort of motivation to move on to the second part of my talk, where I would like to discuss backhoe imaging. And so as you know, the recent observation from very long baseline interferometry from the Event Horizon Telescopes collaboration are pushing the boundary of the detection of possible deviations from GR closer to the scale of the horizon. And as we have just seen before, some new physics beyond GR can modify the image features of black holes. And I want to show you this image where we considered two spacetimes beyond GR. So this is a black hole and this is horizonless spacetime. And they lead to specific image features concerning the photon rings. So in the first case, you can see that there is a larger ring separation compared to the GR case. So as you know, there is a concentric set of photon rings, and they are separated. And this in this case, the separation is larger than what you would have in the GR case. And for the horizontal spacetime, you get a new set of photon rings, which are more towards the center. So I would like to say that the photon rings are indeed the feature to look at if you want to look for new physics.
So, but I see many rings, like more than two rings in the image.
Sorry, in this one?
Yeah, for example, that one.
Yeah, you get an inner set of, you have in general more than two rings, right? You have exponentially.
So you have two values of rings?
Yeah, those spacetime are different. So here, this is a horizontal spacetime, which has reflective surfaces and therefore produces a new set of photon rings.
So, sorry, which one is that inner ring that you're talking about? The innermost?
I mean, it's hard to see, but You get more rings, right? You don't have this usual central brightness depression that you have here. You get some new inner ring here. You can think of two sets, one labeled by, N and one labeled by M.
Okay.
Those are really like two different sets. And the ones labeled by M are more concentrated towards the center than the others.
Yeah, I remember people talking about this horizontal compact object, right? Like
mm-hmm.
you have one unstable photon ring outside the object and one stable photon ring inside the object. So I guess you may have similar things here. So the inner ring is stable. But in terms of observational signatures, do you have any like difference between these two family of rings, or it's just
I don't think there is really. I mean, not that you can really measure. I mean, they look very very similar, except that the location, some are closer to the center and some are more external.
Yeah, I mean, for the unstable rings, you can label as you said. You have this ends, which is the 1D number,
mm-hmm.
I wonder whether you have similar index for the inner ring.
But I have to admit that I don't know about their stabilities.
Okay.
I don't know whether the inner set of photon rings are stable or unstable.
Yeah, people show that the inner photon ring has to be stable. Has to be stable. The outer one has to be unstable.
Mm. Yeah, the outer one is. Yes.
Yeah. Sorry. This was, for example, I mean, in order for it to look like this, what would be the scale physics would start changing?
That's what I'm going to move on a bit, if I have time. Was it your question? Okay. Thanks. So, one question we have been looking at is, okay, you might have, I mean, you have these photon rings. You can basically focus on cases where you have only two rings for particular purposes. And how can you assert the detectability of two rings in your images? Because as you can see here, this is like the ideal image, but what the Event Horizon Telescope is going to see is like a sort of blurred version of that. So when it's when the uncertainties of your telescopes are taken into account, what can you expect? And how can you assert the detectability of two rings? You can do that at three different levels. There is the image plane and the Fourier plane. And within the Fourier plane, you also have two different quantities you can look at. What we have been doing in the image plane is to construct some simple models of image plane data. So you construct a model for two rings, that is a simple geometric models. And these models depend on several parameters, which are described here. So you take one parameter to be the diameter of your outer ring, one to be the width of your outer ring, the width of the inner ring, S is the separation between the two, then F dot is the total flux in your image, and delta F is the ratio between the fluxes of your two different rings. So those are the parameters you want to look at, and you consider wide enough ranges to cover all potential cases, I mean, two-ring cases. I'm not going into details, but basically what you want to do is to construct several images with different values of the parameters and fit them with Gaussian rings, one ring and two rings, and assert for which parameters are they detectable. I mean, for which parameters the second ring gives a different result than the first ring. I would like to focus more on the UV plane. So as we have seen, the image plane is quite naive. I mean, you have very simple geometric models to construct your rings. So it just serves as a motivation for a more in-depth study of the rings. And this in-depth study can be done in the UV plane, where you translate your image plane data into visibility amplitude. So your I of X and Y is your brightness model or intensity model that you had in your image plane. And then you Fourier transform in the UV plane to get the visibility data. And your U and V are forming what the so-called baselines. And so why we, I mean, which models did we decide in the image plane? We decided to use the Cresson model and the Gaussian model for the rings. And why did we decide it for the Cresson model is that although it's very simple, so it's a flat ring, it has an analytical expression in the visibility domain. So this V of UV is analytical for the Cresson model. So what you're doing in the UV plane, you take your image plane data and you convert that into the Fourier plane, so with visibility. You also consider actual arrays, either from EHT or next generation EHT. And this gives you what is the UV coverage that is accessible for this particular configuration of telescopes. And with that, you can obtain the visibility amplitude seen by such an array. So that is what you obtain. So you have your two-ring model and you get this. And now you would like to fit with a one-ring model and the two rings to see what are the differences. Can I get back my two-ring model, or is my two-ring model better than the first ring? So you can do that. So you consider two Gaussian rings and you fit with your Kreshot model. Here you can see that they are fairly similar. So the one ring fit and the two ring fits, which are in red and blue, are fairly similar for most of the baselines. The only difference lies here. You might or might not see there is a blue dot on top of the red, which indicates that it starts, so the two ring and the one ring model starts to deviate at a larger baseline. Did you have a question?
Sorry.
Ah, okay. Great. And what you do afterwards is you perform a KS test and you look at the p-value, and whenever your p-value is smaller than 0.05, you would assert detectability. And in that case, the p-value is actually larger, so you would not say that you have detected two rings. Okay. Last question is, how do one ring and two rings look in terms of closure quantities? So far we have looked at the visibility amplitude, but this visibility amplitude, as you measure it, is affected by some thermal noise from your instrument and also by gain factors. So if you want some unbiased quantities to look at, you would go for closure quantities. So what we have done here is to plot the logarithmic closure amplitudes in function of the quadrangle parameter. So the closure quantities needs four different stations to be defined. And these four different stations, you can derive their perimeter, right? And you can do that for various four stations in your arrays of stations. So in that case, we were using evenly separated array, square array, of either 400 station or 40,000 station. And you compute the logarithmic closure amplitude for each chronicle parameter. And you do that for both the one ring in blue and the two ring in red. And so you can see that in the first case, which is the standard representation of this quantity, it's very hard to tell apart the one ring and two ring model. They look very similar and it's somehow messy. So you can try to go for another representation where you can better disentangle these two models. And in this second plot, what has been doing is you slice your parameter space by fixing three stations and by moving only one. So you fix three telescopes and you are moving one. And by doing that, you can obtain a clear representation. It's a slice in your five-dimensional parameter space. And here you can see more clearly differences between the one-ring and the two-ring models. Right? So the location of those divergences, because this is logarithmic, single out the zeros of the visibility amplitude, and those zeros are determined by your ring model. So dependent on the location of these divergences, you can single out a particular ring model. And here you can see that at least three divergences are needed to start disentangling the one ring and the two ring model. Right? They start to differ more and more towards a larger quadrangle parameter. Okay. So I would like to conclude. What we have seen in the principal parameters approach is that this approach, where there is new physics that motivates deviations in your metric, leads to a particular feature that are different from the classical case of gravitational collapse. Right? Then you can go beyond the simplest model we use, especially in the AS-inspired upgrade, and this is what Alicia and Johanna have been doing here at Perimeter. Concerning the parameterization beyond circularity, so circularity is an assumption that needs not to hold, and non-circular metrics are better expressed in horizon penetrating coordinates. But what remains to do is to derive the most general non-secure parameterization, both in Boyer-Gilchrist and in horizon penetrating. So the one that encodes all possible cases, right? And finally, concerning the detection of two rings in black hole images, this can be done at three different levels, so the three different quantities or plane. And this is expected to improve with the next generation event horizon telescope, where you have more stations and maybe another frequency of observation. But what remains to do is to take into account the disk model, and more importantly, that there is direct emission in your image that has most of the flux that you observe. This we have not been considering. So, thank you very much.
Questions?
Yes, who was first?
Yeah, thanks for that talk. I was wondering if you could just comment about your decision to focus on the like EHT type observations for in particular, in the beginning of your talk, you mentioned this motivation of introducing some new small length scale which get new physics. So if you're thinking about theories like that, should you consider the smallest black holes that you can find, like stellar mass ones as opposed to supermassive ones, to get the best kinds of constraints in that theory?
Can you repeat? Sorry, I didn't.
Yeah, just wondering about your why particularly you chose to focus on EHT type observations of supermassive black holes when the curvature scale of those will be much, much larger compared to stellar mass black holes, which were also observationally something you're pretty thinking about having some modification of gravity that occurs, you know, at some
scale below. So basically what we use to look at the visibilities is a tool called EHT Imager. And this one, I mean, is based on EHT observations. So if you want to incorporate how an actual array of stations is seeing the black holes, this was a way to do it, right? Because they already have the IRS implemented, and they already have the routine implemented. So, I mean, otherwise you would have to create your own code, create your own arrays of telescope and see how you can fake an observation. Right.
So can I clarify an answer to this question that people can check if it is right or wrong?
Yeah.
I think that the way it is done is there's no theory underlying. There's a metric that is proposed, which is kind of motivated by some modifications of Kerr and Schwarzschild metrics and so on. And then the question is, what are the observable effects you can extract out of that? You want to get something like solar mass black holes, other observations that are driven by waves, something which requires a theory, detailed theory. So they have found a clever niche in which you can do the observations knowing only the space-time geometry and not knowing the theory. Mm-hmm. And that is provided by EHT, right? Because that is EHT technique. That really focuses just on geometry and not worrying about dynamical processes that are actually happening in geometry.
Yes, well, we can do consider every system the same thing.
You can
consider an extreme laser issue while still talking, having just a metric. And
yeah, there are other tools where you can start from a metric, right. But we decided to.
I'm talking about astrophysical black holes, a thing that we have control.
Yeah.
Those really come from gravitational nature. It's really quite understanding of dynamics of the theory.
Right.
Do you agree with that?
Yeah, but I guess the point is if you really believe that we should introduce one small length scale and you start modifying gravity, then you if it's any deviation for supermassive black holes will be,
But this is
really, really large for stellar mass black holes.
Yeah, but you only have access to that at the moment.
You don't necessarily have to make that assumption.
But they will be large, but they are not observable.
Yeah, but if it's observable there, people for sure would see something weird in life.
I think you're putting a solid assumption that it's like all the right? So if you really say, well, this is a metric that we expect there's a uniqueness theorem in whatever theory that actually holds, then for sure, you know, the effects will be much larger for solar mass black holes than for supermassive black holes. But I mean, any uniqueness theorem for you know, like black holes is something very specific to GR, and the simplest modifications of GR, you know, just adding higher order curvature terms, already produce multiple black hole solutions. And so, therefore, it's not clear whether this type of metric, right, whether this would be a description of just the supermassive black holes or solar mass. Because, you know, if you have several black hole solutions, then it might depend on the formation history, which where you end up, and so on. So there's assumptions in you know, taking data from very, very different mass scales for black holes and saying you have already constrained those mass scales. And those assumptions are quite similar.
Yeah, I just want to understand your more than the detailed work. So let me put in. So what one is saying is, well, I write a metric in certain vortex that people have been using it, and I modify it without knowing where that modification comes from. That's the idea.
Mm-hmm.
And then we want to know. And we test the geometry that is on this metric. But there's a huge amount of arbitrariness in, because, for example, if I were to do this problem, I would have probably started with the Gaussian metric, Gaussian form of the metric, because it's really valid all the way, you know, everywhere. And then I would have modified that, the extra parameters that come in that Gaussian form of the metric. It's not at all clear to me that those modifications are the same as these modifications. They're probably not.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's a huge amount of arbitrariness here, even within the restricted philosophy of not worrying about the fundamental theory from which this came from. And so, as I see it, what the great value of this would be to have just some concrete examples that people who are doing observations can have back in their mind and see if something like this happens. I would be shocked if in fact you are so lucky, or I'm so lucky, if I were doing a discussion, that one actually finds something like that. This can happen, but that's an accidental thing. I mean, it's not a fundamental theory or even a phenomenological theory. It's not it's just a solution that one is modifying, so to say. So, is that right? Is that correct? I mean, am I capturing your viewpoint correctly? That in fact, what one is doing is one is giving them some. It's not that these are the only ones, they can be many more, but concrete illustrations of differences that one might find that may perhaps be useful. It's not that I would expect these differences to actually show up, but you know, it's conceptual framework that you provide. Is that correct?
Yeah, I would say that's a good description. And in particular, if you look at sort of the many, very many different things that you could write down beyond GR, many of those would sort of differ in observational signatures at the level of details, which are way beyond anything that can be resolved. So it's sort of useful to think of these parameterized classes and sort of understand, are there some sort of generic features? Like for instance, here these large separation of photon rings, and that sort of motivates to say, okay, so this is maybe something that in actual observations we can go ahead and see, would it be possible to resolve two photon rings? Because if yes, then that would be something that many beyond GR cases produce. If you shocked if any of the metrics that Elise has written down would be a good description of an actual metric.
Yeah,
no, it's a phenomenological model to get some intuition for what one should be looking for in the data.
Yeah. Contrasting the probability predictions with something else, not because one believes in that something else strongly, but still because it gives you a conceptual framework to look for deviations.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I just wanted to add that, I mean, if we are basing on these principles, and if we don't observe the features that are, we think are associated to these principles, then we can also rule them out, right?
It's not a specific thing you have done. You cannot rule out.
Yeah, exactly. But at least you can specific this.
But that's not,
it constrains your parameter space. Yes.
Have you looked at changes to the ISCO or orbital frequencies a little further from the horizon, because we have on the smaller black holes for solar mass, we have all these X-ray observations of accretion disks up to the ISCO, and to try to measure the spins and things. And so, do you have any in this phenomenology around there? If you guys
Not really, I would say, at least not in what I have done myself. But we tried looking at arrays with another frequency of observation, for example. Yeah, so there is a little bit of freedom by adding some new stations, by changing your frequency of observation to see whether the detection is sharper or larger. But not at the level of disco or whatever of that kind.
Related to Will's questions, for example, if this metric, the deviation from Kerr is like 0.1% or 1% for supermassive black hole, this deviation to be order 1 or even larger for stellar mass black hole?
Yeah, that would be an interesting question, but we haven't
looked at that. Then the East Coast frequency would be very different. And disk would be very different.
Yeah, that's a good point. Thanks. Yes?
Yeah, yeah. So thank you first. The point that I can't understand why you chose EHT. I thought it's widely accepted that EHT cannot resolve with, I mean, whatever we are seeing,
yeah,
EHT and disk. I mean, talking about any constraint.
Well, you can think that
your background model using EHT, I thought it's widely accepted that you cannot talk about that.
So at the moment, it's true that with the EHT resolution, we are not able to distinguish.
EHT cannot resolve the ring. This is what.
Okay, I have two things to say. So, in general, you can say that the first photon ring, so the most outer one, is still affected by astrophysics, right? But as you go towards the more central one, you expect them to be, more linked to the space-time structure themselves and not really affected by the astrophysics. So here we said two rings. We did not say which rings we were looking at because we didn't want to make this assumption. But when you're taking rings closer and closer, higher order photon rings, you expect them to be almost entirely dependent on the space-time structure.
Yeah, but the point is that EHT cannot detect.
Yes, but that's why we also consider some extensions of the EHT capabilities, namely the next generation.
At all, EHT, even if you cover the entire Earth with telescopes, cannot resolve rings. This is what I
think. So there are two things. So you can increase the density of your array by just increasing the number of your telescopes on Earth, and then you get just more points, right? You have a better UV coverage in that sense. And then you, ideally, to resolve smaller scales, you would like to extend your baselines. And for that, I agree, you need, larger baselines means that you need to separate more your telescopes, and therefore on Earth it is limited, right? So there are some proposals for this space-based telescope, but there are some other problems.
I agree. And the EHT specifically.
You have sort of three points where you can play, right? The density, the sensitivity of your telescopes as well, and then increasing the baselines. And you have to find what you can do, what is possible, and what you should look at, right? What is most important.
But that was my question. Why? Because EHT cannot do that.
Yeah, but current EHT.
Yeah, black hole detector, for example.
So black hole. Yeah, right. So what has been looked at is, what capabilities of an array do you need to detect separated photon rays in VR?
Yeah.
And this is the idea where you could have.
Yeah, I understand all of this. Just the point I was shocked at. Why are you using EHT for detection?
Why? Because you have data for it. you have data for it, right? So it's a first step, and then you would like to extend.
We had a couple of weeks ago here that it was a hard discussion in the group that. Yeah, EHT cannot constrain
GR.
I thought that is why they accept it.
But the current version.
It might not be accepted at all. It's true that there's astrophysics and physical uncertainty, but it's not a correct statement that the EHT cannot constrain GR. That's simply not a wrong statement.
And even the EHT is an evolving notion, right? As we add more stations, the current EHT has, I think, 11 stations, if I'm correct. But you can, this is a evolving notion.
Yeah, just put a station on the moon and that solves your problem. Okay, any other questions? Sure.
Okay. So
are these spacetimes where the singularity has been resolved geodesically complete? Or what do you mean by resolving into singularity?
Sorry, what I mean by?
So you described this, for example, some metrics where you had some horizon, right?
Yes.
A singularity inside.
Yes. It was at the level of the curvature, scalar curvature invariant.
So the curvature does not blow up, but
yes.
It's incomplete.
Yes, this is something, I mean, at least for the gravitational collapse case, this is something we wanted to investigate, but since it's work in progress, this is work in progress.
Yeah, there's no way to have a correct no singularity in the sense of incompleteness, right? Because you form a structure of this, and then this will eventually necessarily form.
Hmm.
Yeah, but that's, yeah.
But then, thanks.
Yeah, but, yes.
So the images of your, I think they were the, I can't remember if it was the circular or the non-circular case, but some of the secondary rings were very small compared with the outer ring. What is what do those orbits look like? Are those photons coming from? Was that light ring still larger than the event horizon, or are the photons doing weird?
No, they're as far as I am aware, they are like normal standard orbits. That are not within the horizon or whatever something.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, if no more questions, let's thank Lucy. Okay, well, nice.